Welcome to Technology and the Arts, a bi-weekly podcast exploring the connections between the worlds of technology and art. In this installment, we'll hear from J.G. Birdsall, writer and director of the upcoming science fiction vidcast, Venus Rises. Plus, we'll discuss Noodlebib, the IT Crowd, a television program in the UK, the launch of the Apple iPhone, and the latest animated film from Pixar and Disney, Ratatouille. We'll talk about all of this and more just ahead on Technology and the Arts for Wednesday, July 4th, 2007. Now, here are your hosts, Brian Kelly and John Lemazny.
Welcome to another edition of Technology and the Arts podcast. As always, Technology and the Arts seeks to explore the connections between technology and art, and to establish a forum for discussing the impact technology has made on the human creative process and on literature, music, and the visual and interactive arts.
And to let you know who we are, my name is Brian Kelly. I'm a journalist by trade, amateur songwriter, musician, and science and technology enthusiast living in central New Jersey.
And I'm John Lemazny, a father, artist, musician, poet, and technologist living in New Jersey.
We have a great show coming up for this 4th of July edition of the podcast, including an interview with J.G. Birdsall, the talented writer and director of the upcoming science fiction vidcast, Venus Rises, which can be found at www.venusrises.tv. But first, John and I recorded our usual conversation for this part of the podcast during a recent late-night visit to the Crystal Diner in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Here is that conversation.
John, it's good to see you again. How you doing?
Good to see you too, Brian. Just want to thank the Crystal Diner in Lawrenceville, in New Jersey, for hosting us tonight. They have a great spinach wrap and delicious coffee.
And the carrot cake wasn't bad.
Yeah, and they're here 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so come enjoy.
Fulfilling all our podcasting studio needs.
And coffee needs, too.
Yes. Oh, how was your vacation, by the way?
It was very, very nice, and I appreciate you allowing me to give you a call instead of normally the way that we normally do it. And it's nice that we have technology like this that can allow us to continue the conversation even when we're not in the same space. But it's nice to see you in person, too. How about you, Brian?
Well, as I mentioned in the last podcast, my friend and March 21st Technology and the Arts guest, Christian Beach, is playing at the Saint in Asbury Park, New Jersey on July 13th and asked me to play some keyboards on three of his songs. So we had our first rehearsal the other night and things went pretty well for our first night of learning the parts. And I'm hoping everything goes well and I have a successful return to the stage after 16 years. So that's Friday, July 13th at the Saint in Asbury Park. Come see Christian Beach, and I encourage you to go to www.myspace.com/Christian Beach and check out his stuff. It's really, really good. And if you're in the area, please come out and see that. That's all that's really going on as far as I'm concerned. John, what would you like to talk about this week?
Well, I have a couple things I want to talk about. Firstly, I know that we're going to talk about it later, but I just wanted to say congratulations to Steve Jobs and Apple for releasing what is, at least from a marketing perspective, an unmitigated smash success in the iPhone, despite the AT&T network.
Yes, and we'll be talking more about that later and hearing from people who were online at one Apple store location who were waiting for the iPhone on June 29th. So, stay tuned for that.
While we're speaking about Apple, I wanted to say that one of the first Christmas gifts that I got my wife after we got married in 1999 was an Apple iBook. It was actually one of the things that we had in common, was a love for Apple technology. And like I said, one of the first gifts I got her was this iBook, the white 12-inch iBook. And I got it fully packed, as much RAM as would fit in there at the time. and it's been a great machine. I've had it up until now. I should say she's had it up until now. And suddenly on our vacation trip, it stopped working, which incidentally was a showstopper for the trip, in part because I needed it in order to do my distance learning work for my course. I was going in on a daily basis and doing a lot of work there, and without the laptop, I ran out of a way to do the work that I needed to do. So if for no other reason, that was why we came home.
I'm sorry to hear about that.
Yeah, so the reason the laptop stopped working specifically was the screen died, the LCD screen, and we're not quite sure about what made the screen die specifically. It certainly wasn't dropped or anything.
That happened in my iBook. That was the problem. The screen kept on going dark on me, and I would be angling the iBook at certain angles, and it would come back, but it was...
We had that problem, and we got that fixed. That was actually, they extended the warranty to cover that problem.
Interesting.
But we got that taken care of a couple years back. This is a different problem, and we think it's the logic board. The interesting thing is this machine is out of warranty. There would be no way for us to get a warranty that would be reasonable, because any amount of money we spend would probably go better towards a new PowerBook, MacBook Pro or something. And at $1,000 or less as an entry level, that's pretty good. It's hard to argue for $300 towards keeping an old machine going when you can spend $1,000 to get a brand new one. At any rate, the thing that was nice was they said if it is a logic board and you want us to do it, I took it to it at the Apple store in, what's the mall on 206?
Bridgewater Commons?
Went to Bridgewater Commons Apple store, which I guess I didn't really know that there was one that was that close, and it was interesting. So we went there, and they said if we do it here, one of our geniuses do it, it's going to cost you as much as it would to just get a new machine, or pretty much. But we can send it out to the depot for $300 flat rate, and if it's logic board, they'll take care of it. And if it's something else, then we won't, you won't be any worse than you are, worse off than you are now. So we haven't heard the outcome of that, but right now for $300, we might extend the life of that machine for another 3 to 5 years or whatever, at which point, you'll be able to fit a MacBook Pro in your ear. The next thing I want to talk about, and special thanks to Sean Piotrowski at Rider University OIT, who turned me on to this show. There is a show in England called the IT Crowd that apparently has been brought to America in the same way that The Office, a smash success overseas, was, and so many British shows are now being brought over to American television and being Americanized. The IT Crowd, as you might suspect, it's sort of like The Office in that it focuses on office life and specifically talks about how an IT department, it's a comedy, an IT department supports the organization that they're supporting and deals with some of the problems that they encounter, such as the endless phone calls about the common problems that they're answering the same questions all the time, and they do it with a really sort of British sensibility of humor, and they do it with there's a lot of stuff for a technologist to really grab onto, such as there's like bumper stickers all over the wall of the office of the guy who's one of the main characters that have to do with the Electronic Frontier Foundation and open source technology and all these little things that for a technologist who's in the know is very interesting. And then they bring technology into the jokes, and for a technologist it's a really fun show. And apparently it is coming over to American broadcasting, so I'm really looking forward to seeing what they do with it. And the only way it was available to me, as Brian knows with a lot of Doctor Who shows, is by torrent files. And I was able to get the whole first season in one night. It was a gig of downloads, but I would love to pay somebody for the opportunity to see the show, but they just don't have an outlet that I know of where I would be able to get that show, and I'd be able to get them at the quality that I got them.
I don't think it's been on BBC America yet, but it might be coming.
And if it was on BBC America, I would be happy to watch it there.
It should be, because they're bringing a lot of, like, Torchwood, the Doctor Who spinoff, that's coming to BBC America.
Well, that's what happened.
The second season of Life on Mars, so that's all coming to BBC America, which is really stressing now the shows that are popular in the UK. You know,
because if they're popular there, American and Britain have similar sensibilities, unfortunately, in a lot of cases.
Unfortunately, the David E. Kelly-backed Americanized version of Life on Mars did not get picked up. So
I don't know about the original, and I don't know about the Americanized version, but The Office has been an amazing success in both countries. And while in the British version they decided to stop it after two seasons, and a season over there is only six episodes usually, that's a pretty limited way to explore a show. But in the eyes of
Ricky Gervais,
he had found all of the possible outcomes that he could explore in that show, and he wanted to move on to other shows.
Well, I think the other thing is that you see in the Americanized version of The Office, you know, it started out as being this documentary, and obviously that, even though that feel, that look is there, it's kind of ridiculous to think that this documentary is still getting shot.
The ridiculousness of it is apparent even in the original. I mean, it really is it's sort of like it gives license to somebody like Ricky Gervais to be such an ass, because he's in front of a camera, and so you always see him like glancing over at the camera. The IT crowd, keep an eye out for it, probably on ABC. A Noodle Bib. Noodle Bib is a technology mostly useful for anybody who's doing research that requires either ALA, MLA, or APA stylized
reports.
Cited papers, reports, articles, academic papers. And the way that it works is that you sign in, you get an account usually, and you start to collect books. And the way that you collect books is you say, or magazines or any other citable material, and you fill out a form, essentially. You click on new book, and you fill in the first name of the author, last name of the author, middle name. And the outcome is that because there's no place to fill in anything that doesn't belong there, and because everything that you can fill in there is fully explained. In other words, it says, click here for more information about this part of the citation. You can research it if you want to in the typical way. Wow. And what it does is it takes all the information you throw into that form and it makes a perfectly cited reference, bibliographic reference, using the American Psychology Association or the MLA style reference requirements. I mean, it applies those rules to it. So it really takes what can be really intimidating and difficult for a new student in a graduate study environment, myself included, who's never worked with APA style before but is required to make sure that all the papers that they turn in are APA styled, takes all the work out of having to make sure that all those things are correct, you know. So I just wanted to give a nod to Noodle Bib. And if you happen to be a part of Rider University's student body, you actually can go to the library site at rider.edu/libraries and find the link for Noodle Bib. And anybody who has a Rider account also has the ability to use Noodle Bib for free, which typically you would have to pay either like $5 or $7 a year in order to use. So, Noodle Bib. How about you, Brian? Anything you'd like to tell our listeners about?
Well, I just want to talk about, as mentioned before, June 29th being Steve Jobs Day, apparently, with the simultaneous release of the iPhone and the movie Ratatouille from Disney and Pixar, which, as most of you probably know, is run by Steve Jobs, or is owned by Steve Jobs. And, you know, I went to Freehold Raceway Mall in Freehold, New Jersey on Friday afternoon on June 29th, and talked to some of the people that were waiting online. I think the first person got there at 10 or 11 p.m. the night before. And when I got there, it was kind of funny. The line stretched along the side of the mall where the Apple store was, and then jumped across to the center court of the mall where they're doing this construction. And it ran all along this construction wall, around this court, and basically the end of it was literally about 30 feet away from the line at the AT&T store, which is about 15 people. So there's like 100 plus people waiting online for the Apple store, and there's 15, 20 people waiting at the AT&T store.
They were available at both stores?
Yes. They were available at both stores, but all the people were waiting to get into the Apple store. I don't know if it's the lure of the Apple store. Some of the people were Apple fans, obviously, but some of the people, especially as you'll hear, the people at the very front of the line were more interested in profiting from selling iPhones that they were going to buy. And I'm wondering if it's because the Apple store was not checking credit to buy the phone, to buy the iPhone, but the AT&T stores were, because I guess
it's bizarre.
Yeah, so I guess people figured they could get away with, you know, buying the iPhone at the Apple store, and because it wasn't like they were going to be needed to be qualified for AT&T service anyway. Because they were going to sell the phones, or at least, you know, most of the phones they were going to buy. But anyway, let's hear from some of the people that I talked to on June 29th, waiting in front of the Apple store for the iPhone.
This is Brian Kelly reporting for Technology and the Arts. It is iPhone Day, June 29th, 2007, the day on which Steve Jobs and Apple Incorporated unleashed its latest shiny new toy upon the world. I visited the Apple store at Freehold Raceway Mall in central New Jersey, less than 3 hours before the iPhone went on sale at 6 p.m. local time. I talked to a few people online and asked them why they were there and what attracted them to the iPhone. Here's what they told me.
When did you get here?
I got here at 10 p.m. last night.
How did they set that up with the security here? What was the deal when you got here?
They had rails and like caution signs and all that stuff. There were two lines, one for AT&T, one for Apple.
And what possessed you to come here and try and get an iPhone on the first day?
Make money and basically get a phone for free.
And when did you get here?
My name is Vicky, and I got here at 2 a.m.
What possessed you to come out and wait online for an iPhone?
They were going, like, I guess a lot of people are selling it. I'm going to sell mine also. So they're selling for double what it costs. So I figured I could pay my bills by selling it. I'm just waiting.
Are you going to get just the one or the two? And then
getting two and selling both.
What are your plans with the iPhone? Are you...
I'm going to buy four. I'm going to sell three and keep one.
Okay. Do you have somebody here with you to buy the...
My dad's coming in like 30 minutes.
Okay, so you'll buy two. And, okay.
And I'll buy four.
Good plan. So you're going to keep one. So obviously, you know, you like the phone. You're attracted to the phone. What excites you the most about the iPhone?
That would possess you to... The touch screen and like the design that has no buttons and stuff.
Okay, so of all the features on the iPhone, which ones like excite you the most?
I like the internet. The internet on it. The web browser looks real cool.
Yeah, Safari does.
I mean, Safari is crazy. Just like the internet on the phones now, kind of stink.
Yeah, exactly.
The actual web page, I mean, that's pretty cool. I mean, yeah, I can deal with that.
Switching to landscape view, I mean, that was...
Yeah, well, that's always good. Like, also, yeah, that's... I love that. It just switches up.
Anything,
I think just overall, I think it's just totally different than what's out there now, you know? I just think overall, everything's amazing about it.
So that's some of what I encountered from the people I met online waiting for the iPhone. And later that night, my girlfriend and I went to go see Ratatouille. The latest in what is surely to be the next hit for Disney and Pixar. If you don't know, it's about a rat who has this heightened sense of taste and smell, and winds up being introduced to cooking through a French chef that he sees on TV and reads in a book in the house of the human that where they live, and then something happens and he winds up in the center of Paris and at this restaurant, and the rat winds up helping this young slacker basically and turns him into this master chef. But it was a very, very funny movie, very good movie. I strongly recommend it. The animation is incredible. Paris looks spectacular in the Pixar animated world where it lives. Brad Bird, who did The Incredibles, does another fantastic job with Ratatouille. And when the movie started, all I could think of was that Steve Jobs is making a lot of money today. So I definitely recommend a trip to the movie theater to see Ratatouille. But now it's time for the Technology and the Arts events calendar.
This is your Technology and the Arts events calendar. Soundmarks, which runs from June 8th through August 18th, 2007, at Art Interactive in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is an exhibit of site-specific sound and video installations by Amy Stacy Curtis and the team of Zach Poff and M.B. Aldridge. Employing both new media and traditional audio technologies, these artists experiment with ways in which art can serve as a catalyst for common experience and a site for community exchange. For more information about Soundmarks, visit www.artinteractive.org or call 617-498-0100. To stay informed about events related to technology and the arts, please remember to check out the Technology and the Arts events page at techarts.wordpress.com. It's now time to hear from our guest for this podcast. J.G. Birdsall is a New Jersey-based filmmaker who is the driving force behind Venus Rises, an upcoming science fiction vidcast that can be found at www.venusrises.tv. And it's most appropriate that we talk about a story involving Mars and Venus during this 4th of July podcast. It was 10 years ago, on July 4th, 1997, that NASA's Pathfinder landed on Mars. So without further ado, here is my conversation with J.G. Birdsall. Could you start out by stating your name and giving our listeners a little background about yourself?
My name is Jason Birdsall. I'm the writer-director of Venus Rises. I went to school at Full Sail down in Florida. It was a film school. And I'm a video editor by profession.
What got you into filmmaking?
Well, I actually drew comics. I was into comics when I was really young. And I was really into the comic books that continued the storyline over a series. And it's progressed from there. I've always been interested in film as a medium and the web now more so.
What are some of your influences, especially in terms of science fiction?
Oh, Star Trek, Babylon 5. There's a list of them that I just, even going back to Forbidden Planet, Logan's Run, Day of the Earth Stood Still. I just love science fiction. I've been influenced by television, by series, the idea that when you, as Babylon 5, JMS, he took the risk of making sure his audience was with him for 5 years, that the little things that he put in his storylines that made you scratch your head and wonder, what does this mean? And you won't know until two or three seasons later. He took a bet that the network was going to keep him and that he would have the audience would still hang around for the moment, for when it all comes together. Things like that make me, that influenced me in the way I wrote Venus Rises as a series, because in a movie, beginning and end, that's really it. And I want people to discover the characters and learn more about them through time.
Can you tell us about the genesis and evolution of the Venus Rises project?
Venus Rises started out when I was, I kind of got into Lightwave, which is a 3D animation program. And I got into doing little animations here and there with it. And started to release it online and let people see what I was doing. But I wanted more. The little stories that I could do with just ships flying around was at its point where I wanted to do a little bit more with it, which meant trying to get people. And that meant trying to do green screen and things. So I started to look into what avenues I had, and I actually started to write some fan films. Started after a Star Wars fan film, then I tried to do a Star Trek fan film. But nothing ever panned out. And after a while, I decided, well, why don't I just create something original, something that I create the universe for, and I felt that enticed me more. So I started to pen Venus Rises, and all the whole time, Venus Rises was meant to be on the internet. So the whole structure of the story was kept small in tidbits that I could, at the time, back in 02, the bitrate, the download rates, the upload rates were really tiny. So I created little clusters of story that you would be able to download. So and Venus Rises came out of all that, plus all the current events that were going on at the time. I mean, I kind of just dipped into to a lot of things. I wanted to keep Venus Rises more science fact than science fiction.
The sets you built are pretty ambitious. Can you tell us what went into assembling the parts you needed and constructing the sets?
Well, I went online and did a lot of research looking at what NASA was capable of doing and what they had done, creating the shuttle and the Apollo missions. And I wanted to have it look familiar. I didn't want it to look too high tech. And the story, Earth was made uninhabitable very fast. And the human race had to leave Earth quickly. So they had to use the tried and true method and not really explore new technologies just yet. What went into the sets was a lot of eBay. I tried to get old NASA modules and a lot of military surplus that I could find. A lot of the things didn't work, and when I got them, I had to take them apart and see what I could make light up and what I couldn't make light up. It was a lot of effort to put these sets together. Science fiction, unfortunately, is one of the tougher genres to do because of that, unless you go all green screen. But I like the actors to be physically interactive with something.
What can viewers expect out of Venus Rises? Can you give us a brief synopsis?
Venus Rises relates to the situation between the two planets. After Earth was evacuated and Mars was settled, it was more of the higher class. It was more the corporations that got us off of Earth than the government. And the corporations set themselves up on Mars, which set itself up for more of the social elite. Venus then, because Mars needed more raw materials to continue its living arrangements, they went moved over to Venus to mine Venus for its ore and mineral, which brought the blue-collar worker. Venus Rises starts off right at about the time that Venus has really had enough. Mars is taxing a lot, increasing the quotas that Venus can't hold to. The workers themselves, they're overworked. They can't fill the quota, which then gets them more behind. Which some of them get injured on the job, possibly, and then there's less of a workforce to fill those increasing quotas. I'm limited by my budget, so it's a smaller story set within the bigger story. So it concentrates on these two guys that are on a space station that orbits Earth, where the space station is an important point because neither planet can reach the other without it. Anyone that leaves Mars to get to Venus needs to stop at this station to fuel to get to Venus and back. So you have these two guys that are pretty much in the middle of it, and the story unfolds through our protagonist's eyes, Sam's.
So what is the current status of the project?
Right now, Episode 1 to Series 1 is in post-production. Episode 2 is what we are currently filming. Episodes 3 and 4 are in pre-production. The first Interspace episode is in post-production, and I have other ones later scheduled, but haven't gotten to those yet. It's all about getting the series done, and the Interspaces come later. What the inner spaces are supposed to be. They're shorter stories. I couldn't tell in the actual series one. In my format, I have to squeeze a lot of information in a very short amount of time. So I kind of just take for granted certain things that the audience is going to kind of come along with. In the inner spaces, it explains some of the side notes that how this get here, how they get there. This allows me to dive more into the universe of Venus Rises and how it's all set up. The good news is that the inner space, the first inner space, is going to be premiered at Gen Con this year in August. We'll have a trailer for episode one and maybe some behind-the-scenes interviews with actors and crew. As for when the series is actually going to be made available, that I really can't answer. Everybody is a volunteer. They do this on their free time, and when people get busy and their schedules get filled up, VR sort of goes on the back burner. So I'm hoping to have episode one done before the end of the year, but we'll have to see how that works in everyone's schedule.
What do you think of the technologies that now make it possible to have larger video files and allow for distribution to a potentially global audience?
I definitely think the internet is going to be the medium to go to. I mean, the world is your audience at that point. You're not being pigeonholed in anywhere, nor time having what time is the show on. I mean, people kind of watch television now when they feel like it with all the devices they have now. They record it, play it when they have time to watch it. They're not being conformed to watch it at this hour, at this night. iPods, PSPs, cell phones. These are all other things to be able to encode the video for and to show it. Video on demand. They want to see it, they just download it right onto their cell phone. I have the dailies. When we shoot, I put it on my phone. I do a little raw edit, and there it is on my phone that I can show everybody that they can see and how it looks. And if there's a scene that doesn't really work or the way it's cut, I don't have an angle I need, go in and reshoot. But, right on the cell phone.
What do you see in the future for Venus Rises and for yourself?
I wrote Venus Rises, again, like I said, I wrote it like a bigger story. I was going to dip into a series two and a series three. I have the arcs for the characters and for the story itself planned out. I would like to see Venus Rises be picked up enough where I could continue it to a series two and a series three, continue with the characters. I just hope that the fans, the people that watch it, actually enjoy it. I'm a sci-fi fan, and I'm writing a sci-fi episodic show, and I'm writing what I would want to see.
I would like to thank J.G. Birdsall for taking the time to do that interview for us. Actually, what you heard was a second take. The first interview I did with him did not come out due to user error on my part with my iRiver IFP 890. So I especially want to thank him for taking additional time out of his extremely busy schedule. Also, that was just a small portion of the conversation I had with J.G. Birdsall. Stay tuned next Wednesday, July 11th, for a special Technology and the Arts Dialogue podcast, in which you can hear my entire interview with J.G. Birdsall. But right now, it looks like we're coming to the end of another Technology and the Arts podcast. John, is there anything you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, as always, I'd like to say to our listeners that if you have an idea for a story or know about a show or event related to technology or art, to let us know about it by emailing us at technology.arts@gmail.com. Also, feel free to send an email just to say hi. And you are always welcome to leave a comment on the Technology and the Arts blog.
Well, that closes the curtain on another Technology and the Arts podcast. Remember, we'll have a special Technology and the Arts Dialogue podcast featuring my full interview with J.G. Birdsall next Wednesday, July 11th, 2007. We'll be back with more news, interviews, and helpful resources related to technology and art when we return with our next full podcast on Wednesday, July 18th, 2007. So until then, this is Brian Kelly.
And this is John Lemazny. Take care.
The views expressed by the hosts of Technology and the Arts are not necessarily those of guests of the program. Conversely, thoughts and opinions expressed by guests of Technology and the Arts are not necessarily shared by the hosts. For more information about the podcast you have just heard, please visit Technology and the Arts on the web at techarts.wordpress.com.